Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network. Oh yeah, one more keyword here. Yeah, it's my show. Basically, it's libertarian foreign policy stuff, anti-war stuff. I complain, and then plus also I interview experts and journalists and writers, mostly, kind of thing, about the stuff they know. Today on the show, Peter Van Buren is going to be back on the show. He's a writer and an expert, former State Department guy from Iraq War II. He was a whistleblower about State Department-y things back then. And now he's a writer for the likes of Tom Dispatch, etc. Let's see, today's, if I could spell today right, today's show, Peter Van Buren. And, you know, I would like to also get some yeses from the other people I'd invited. Will Grigg, unfortunately, has had to put us off for a day. And I've not heard back from some of the others I'd invited. Most I spent the morning goofing off, though, so. But anyway, Van Buren, he's pretty good on stuff. He's not always 100% anti-war, but man, pretty damn good. And he's got a great new article at tomdispatch.com that I want him to tell you about. You know, I've been meaning to say something about Irwin Schiff on the show, but I was kind of waiting for Will Grigg, because I'm sure he'll have more to say about it and you know, something insightful and well done and whatever about it. But now, at this point, I've put off getting Will on so long, it's getting to the point where I'm neglecting this topic, and it's really important. So I guess I'll just go ahead and talk about it right now, since I just got reminded of it right now. You may or may not be familiar with Irwin Schiff. He's what Anthony Gregory calls a technicalitarian, which is a particular species of libertarian or kind of right populist who believes that if you only know these secret laws that none of the lawyers know, and say the right words and fill out the right thing and use all lowercase letters and make sure your little American flag doesn't have gold fringe on it and whatever kind of thing, that then you can get away with anything. And they don't really have jurisdiction over you to do this, that, or the other thing. Well, in Irwin Schiff's version of this, you don't have to pay the income tax. Only they do, meaning corporations or government employees. Well, you could argue, believe me, people argued whether that's what the law says or that's what the law doesn't say. It seems to me this is roundly debunked. You know, Lou Rockwell has run numerous articles over the years from people explaining why this stuff really isn't true. And the most important reason why it's not true is because no law ever bound the power of the American government. And if they want to do something to you, they will. And Irwin Schiff is a perfect example of that. Here's a guy who told people, you don't have to pay the income tax. And here, look, I wrote a book about it. You don't have to pay the income tax. And they basically gave him a life sentence. They treated him like a political prisoner would be treated in any third world dictatorship. For daring to tell people that the government doesn't have the right to tax your wages. I mean, if this was really a problem, they could just pass the law and a law and never even mind the 16th Amendment, which does grant them that power if you read it. Not that it was ever officially, you know, legally ratified in the proper way, but whatever. Again, there's no such thing as law, really. All the Constitution says is there shall be a government and it shall have your ass. They can do whatever they want. But anyway, the 16th Amendment authorizes it. But even if it didn't, they don't need amendments now. They can do whatever they want. They haven't bothered amending the Constitution in forever. You know, they had to amend it to prohibit alcohol, but they haven't had to amend it to expand their power in any other way since. Not since the New Deal and the Cold War, especially. So, all they'd have to do is go, oh, geez, did we leave a loophole in there where anyone is exempt from our gangsterism? Here, let us just tighten that up. What's stopping them? So, in other words, he was no threat. Erwin Schiff was no threat. The only people who believe in this technicalitarian stuff are, you know, 0.1% of the population. Right? Wesley Snipes got caught up in this, and they nailed him to a cross. You think you're going to get away with not paying us? And he clearly believed that he was doing the right thing. He'd been told that this is the law, and if you only fill out the thing right, then you're fine. But who else is following that example? You know, what's the point of crucifying Erwin Schiff when it's not like he's making any headway? You know what I mean? They're making an example out of him when no one's paying any attention. No one has ever heard of him. No one even knows who he is. He's making an example out of him for you and me. For the very, very few who've ever even heard of such a thing that you have a choice of whether to be taxed or not. Aren't people in prison over that? Yeah. But anyway, probation and ankle bracelets and restrictions and persecution wasn't enough. They put this guy in prison for the last decade of his life. I read a thing by his son, Peter Schiff, who you're probably much more familiar with, who talked about how they had him handcuffed to his hospital bed. The guy's dying of cancer. Oh, and why is he dying of cancer? Because they refuse to treat him. There's your socialist medicine for you. Oh, all medicine should be free, meaning the cops, the totalitarian police state, the evil blood-soaked empire. They ought to be the boss in charge of all of our doctors and all of our healthcare, huh? Yeah, you thought that through real good, didn't you? Here, Erwin Schiff had skin cancer, and they wouldn't treat it, and they wouldn't treat it until it finally metastasized through his entire body. Then as he's in his 80s, 87 years old, dying of lung cancer, dying of cancer in a hospital bed, they have him shackled to the bed. It's murder, get it? Barack Obama murdered Erwin Schiff. Crucified him in order to make an example, in order to prove a point to you. They can and they will do whatever they want to you. There is no loophole. There is only power. It comes from the barrel of a gun, not law determined by representatives of free men. That is a fairy tale. That is a damn lie. And that's the message here. That's why they did to Erwin Schiff what they did to Erwin Schiff. And look at this. He's got a son who's a multimillionaire, who's famous on cable TV news, worldwide, certainly nationwide. I'm not saying that Peter Schiff is a powerful banker or whatever, but he's not nobody. And yet, he's absolutely powerless in this situation. Absolutely powerless. You know he can afford good lawyers to jump through all the hoops to try to get them. He talks about trying to get them to at least take the goddamn handcuffs off. And there's nothing he could do. Because your government is evil. And it's run by evil men. They had a point to prove. They are your enemy. I think they made their point. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. and, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Peter Van Buren on the dang big mess. So now, let me talk at you about Libya. There's a Benghazi hearing going on right now, and honestly, I didn't watch too much of it. It's going on out of the corner of my eye right now. I think we can take for granted the idea that very little of substance will be discussed here. Everyone, as Nancy Youssef wrote in the Daily Beast, all the congressmen guaranteed to ask all the wrong questions. The real questions are why and how in the world did they figure it was the right thing to do the Libya war in the first place? How could they possibly justify it? And then secondly, what was the ambassador doing in Benghazi? He was just building a consulate there. That's funny because I thought that Libya already had a capital city. Okay, well, whatever. Let's just not pay attention to any of the journalism for the last 4 years that explains exactly what he was doing there. And you can see why the cover-up here. It's simple. I mean, obviously, the national security state itself, they want to clamp down on everything bad that ever happens that they're guilty of and all that. But the Republicans, the war party right, has no incentive to attack her over the war itself, which they were in on and encouraged and criticized her and Obama for taking too long to get started, or the real mission that was going on in Benghazi that got the ambassador killed. Because guess what? The leadership, at least, of the Republican Party, most of the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., I'm not saying all the voters for it, but I'm saying the Republican establishment, they're all for the exact same policy, which was shipping al-Qaeda fighters and weapons to Syria to give to the Muslim Brotherhood and worse. So, the answer to the question, what killed, who killed, and how was it that Ambassador Stevens was killed, isn't that, well, he just didn't have good enough security, and there's a real scandal over the lack of security there and this and that. Well, Nancy Youssef, speaking of Nancy Youssef, she's shown that Stevens himself turned down requests for more security, for military security. Why? As Mark Siebel, the reporter from McClatchy, D.C. himself, just speculated. Oh, no, he was linking to somebody else, Michael Kelly, from Business Insider, speculating, because he was surrounded by CIA. He didn't think he needed a bunch of military security. It wasn't just an ambassador mission. There was, in fact, that's part of the story of the whole firefight and everything, right? First, they attacked the consulate, the makeshift pseudo-consulate there, and then the fight was taken to the CIA undercover house, which wasn't so undercover. So, now, why were they attacked by the people in not just the country, but the specific region that they had sided with in the war, the people that they had just liberated from Gaddafi? And the reason why is because they were al-Qaeda guys, and al-Qaeda guys hate America. And even if America wants to arm them and back them and use them, that doesn't make them like us. In fact, that probably just makes them respect America that much less. Thanks for the guns. Soon enough, they'll be turned on you. And I'll give credit where it's due. Rachel Maddow, right after the attack, she debunked the whole lie about the video made everybody upset, which was actually seem to have had something to do with it, according to the leaders of Ansar al-Sharia, who told that to the New York Times, assuming the New York Times isn't just making that up, had a little something to do with it. But Maddow put forward a much more plausible explanation, which was that in July of 2012, the Americans, with a drone strike in Pakistan, killed an al-Qaeda guy named al-Libi, the brother of the guy that George Bush tortured into accusing Saddam Hussein of teaching accusing Saddam Hussein of teaching al-Qaeda how to make and deploy chemical weapons, hijack airplanes, etc., who Gaddafi later killed for George W. Bush. After America betrayed Gaddafi in favor of al-Qaeda, they're still fighting him in Pakistan. And so Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, July or August 2012, until September of 2012, put out a podcast saying that, hey, our al-Qaeda brethren in Libya, you know what you guys ought to do? You ought to kill some Americans to get revenge for what they did to this guy al-Libi. That means from Libya, right? And so then that's what they did. Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, it was known, it was covered on this show. Check the archives, 2011. It was known on this show from, I'm pretty sure we were saying this before the war ever started. Certainly, you know, within days or something of the war starting, that, hey, look, it's Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the Libyan veterans of Iraq War II, the guys that fought under Zarqawi, al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are. Hell, I should have this clip ready to play at a moment's notice all the time. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, went on CNN and said in any other context, we would call these guys the Mujahideen, the bad guys. And Obama's got us taking their side against Gaddafi, and it ain't right. And the women anchors, they're not even journalists, they're just anchors, the hairdos on CNN are going, but that can't be right. And he's going, yeah, well, look at it. It ain't like Gaddafi's the al-Qaeda guy being attacked by a bunch of nationalists. And he actually laughs at them and says, you're just carrying water for Mr. Obama. But everybody else can see what's going on here. There's no denying it. Patrick Coburn said the same thing. David Enders said the same thing. Pepe Escobar said the same thing. All them reporting from Libya. They went to Libya like, yep, those are al-Qaeda guys. So that's what got Ambassador Stevens killed, is America had allied with its enemies. And arming them and bribing them did not really win them over. And, you know, the fact that Seymour Hersh got smeared for this piece all up and down the entire internet, I think is a great indication that it's really worth your time. It's called The Red Line and The Rat Line. Seymour Hersh on Obama, Erdogan, and the Syrian rebels. Now, this is the story of how Turkey and the al-Nusra Front, that is al-Qaeda, in Syria, staged the sarin gas attack of August 2013 in order to try to get America to bomb Assad out of power. But it's also the story of the rat line of al-Qaeda fighters and guns from Libya, from one catastrophic success to the next, to the next. And, I got more footnotes, too. In turnabout, Syria rebels get Syria weapons. That's the New York Times admitting that. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
I have regrets my regret is that a violent group of people have risen up again. This is Al-Qaeda plus.
All right, Joe, welcome back to the show. I swear to God, the only editing I did of that was just cutting Bob Schaefer out. He is trying to answer the question for the poor guy before he kept interrupting and trying to say something. Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest on the show today is Peter Van Buren, formerly a State Department guy in Iraq War II, and now he's a writer at TomDispatch.com and at his own website, which is WeMeantWell.com, which is the name of one of his books here, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Welcome back to the show, Peter. How are you doing?
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Scott.
Good to have you here. And let's see, did I mention TomDispatch.com? That's where the new one is. The Great War in the Middle East. What if they gave a war and everyone came? And that'll be running at antiwar.com tomorrow under Tom's name, of course. Yeah, what a mess, huh? Your premise here, you start with, what if America had not invaded Iraq? Well, I don't know. I have a whole answer to that. I don't think anybody wants to hear. But instead, what happened is George W. Bush and his government, they did invade Iraq. And as you say, that was sort of the, what's the term you use for it? That was the big fulcrum or whatever, the precipitating event.
Precipitating event.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I just have to put out there that the title of my first book and my blog, We Meant Well, is supposed to be sarcastic. I just got another email this morning from someone who had read the Tom Dispatch article who was chastising me and saying, you know, America did not mean well at all. It's sarcastic, people. Take a look at my blog. It's not hard to figure that out, but I do need to throw that out there. We talk about things, and it was interesting. Bernie Sanders raised this point in the debate where he claimed that Iraq was the worst foreign policy decision in American history. And boy, that's a broad statement. And I started out with the question of, you know, how right was Bernie? And obviously, if you're talking about 220 years of dumbass foreign policy moves, that's, you know, to say which one is actually the worst is a bit of a steep climb. But I'll come to the conclusion that it is in the top handful of them, if in fact it isn't the worst decision. And to frame that, we talk about what you mentioned there, a precipitating event. Causality is difficult. That's direct. A caused B. I threw a brick out the window. It hit a guy. He's dead. Well, me and the brick caused his death. Precipitating event, however, is a term that novelists use, and it's really the thing that kicks off the story. It may or may not cause everything that happens, but it's what starts us all in motion. The guy in Les Miserables steals the loaf of bread, and before you know it, you've got 2 hours of drama that follows. Hmm. With Iraq,
well, now you're a writer, so let me ask you.
Yes,
is it,
sure.
In that term, in writing, is it always something that really came down to somebody's free will and a bad choice that they made? That's the precipitating event. Because you could pin the thing, the beginning, as you said, you could basically start the story anywhere if you want to. But the big deal about Iraq War II that everybody seems to agree on is it was a war of choice, meaning an aggressive war that absolutely did not have to happen at all.
Sure. I mean, as a novelist, I guess you could argue it could have been a natural event, a landslide or a hurricane. But
usually not, though, right? Usually it's because some dumbass.
No, I mean, it's a lot more interesting if it's a conscious decision. And clearly here with when we're looking at what's going on in the Middle East right now, clearly the invasion of 2003 is the event. you know, if we're drinking beers, we could argue that in the first Gulf War was this or was that. But, I mean, for simplicity's sake, you can't really beat the 2003 invasion. I mean, take a look at the Mideast, the afternoon prior to the invasion, if you will. You had stable governments all across the region. They were, you know, some of them were nice guys, some of them were a lot less nice guys, but stability is one of the few things you can sort of hope for in the Middle East. If we want happy guys running every country, it isn't going to happen. But you had stability, and stability, excuse me, stability is what the terrorists hate. It means it's very hard for them to operate. And so stability is, by definition, a good thing. In 2003, the United States kicked that all over and stood by kind of like a slack-jawed yokel and watched it fall apart around us. The Iranians, who initially were terrified of the United States and desperate to cut some kind of a deal with us in 2003 or 2004, I mean, they were facing the American army at the peak of its power on both of their borders in Iran and Afghanistan. And we blew that, and now we're negotiating with them from a position of far less of a power. Syria was a stable country, and that got kicked over into a huge mess. Libya, Egypt, and obviously Iraq itself. There was no ISIS in 2003. There was an Al-Qaeda that actually had been knocked back on its heels fairly effectively in Afghanistan. Bin Laden was hiding out in the mountains around Tora Bora, and Al-Qaeda clearly was not in a position to do very much but try to hang on. You fast forward a few years, Iraq is in complete chaos. Al-Qaeda has resurrected itself in Iraq amid the chaos. The Iranians have gotten their mojo back. By 2011, the United States had abandoned the Arab Spring. Syria had started to slip into a chaotic state. The United States invaded, albeit from the air, Libya and set in motion another failed state. We had deposed the stable leader of Yemen and plugged one of our boys in there, which led on a direct path to the failed state that is Yemen today. And all of those things can be threaded back to the invasion of 2003. And for that, I'm going to have to agree with Bernie Sanders that it probably was one of, if not the worst, foreign policy decisions in America's history.
Yeah. Well, and it was pretty obvious right from the beginning, too, the comparisons to Woodrow Wilson. You know, oh man, the thing you didn't have to do that set off the chain reaction that could destroy the whole station, you know, kind of thing. It was so clear then, and especially in terms of the sectarian war, and I don't mean the, you know, the a religious war necessarily, but just who's fighting who is defined more than anything else by who's on the Sunni side and who's on the Shia side, who's on the Saudi side and who's on the Iranian side. And it was because of America's war in Iraq that, you know, really, or I don't know, you were there, but is it unfair for me to sum up that entire war as the Army and the Marine Corps serving as the loyal sock puppets of the Bada Brigade for a few years to kick all, and the Mahdi Army to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and then get kicked right out ourselves? Really made the change. And then you just look at that from the Sunni point of view. Here's the first time the Shia have ruled an Arab capital city in 1,000 years, and it's Baghdad, and they just can't let that stand. They can't really do anything about it except fling suicide bombers at them forever, but they're not going to stop flinging suicide bombers at them forever.
Again, you know, I wish I could say it was thought out and planned or part of a conspiracy or nefarious planning. But in fact, it was just dumbassery and chaos. You know, the United States went in with America's goals and acted almost sort of surprised to find that there were three large groups within Iraq that didn't like each other. I mean, it was almost like, hey, did you guys know about this? No, I didn't know about this. And quick aside to your listeners who know a lot more about this than I do, you know, we throw out the term Sunni, Shia, Kurd, you know, in the broadest possible sense here. I'm aware that there are many gradations inside of those terms, but for simplicity's sake, we'll use. So, you know, the United States kind of acted like, hey, wow, who knew about this? And sort of couldn't figure out which side we were going to take, who was looking after our interests and who wasn't. And so we muddled around until finally we got tired and left. Those forces were essentially, Sunni Shia Kurd, were essentially genies that were bottled up, if you will, mainly through Saddam's strong-arm tactics. And that by keeping them bottled up, he kept them from influencing as dramatically as we've seen post-invasion the countries in the region. When we invaded, we set those forces loose, we couldn't control them once they got out of the bottle, and they spilled over the borders.
Let me ask you this, though. Mm. Bush and Cheney had retired, and somehow some technocrats had come to administer the thing in a as like an objective way as they could, kind of a thing, without all the very narrow subjective views of the Republicans running that war. And what if they had said, you know, what we ought to do here is negotiate, include the neighbors in the negotiations, figure out the most equitable power sharing type thing that we can, and split. Because instead what we got was, we must stay the course. We can't cut and run. But they were never honest about what they're doing. What they were saying was, now that we're in this, we have to help the Shiites win the civil war. Right? That's what they were really saying. But what if they hadn't done that? What if they had said, okay, Shia, you're the 60% majority, but you don't rule the whole capital city, and we're not going to fight a civil war for you, and left them with that much more incentive to negotiate with the former Baathists and the Sunni powers. You think things might have ended up a little bit better in that case? I would justify overthrowing Saddam and invading in the first place, but seems like they made it worse than even they had to.
Exactly. And I mean, once the invasion starts, you know, you can't imagine it could have turned out any worse. I mean, we could have flown over the country and dropped Viagra and hoped that, you know, the Sunnis and Shias would have been so involved doing, you know, the things you do when you take Viagra, that they would have, you know, not gone after each other. I mean, that's as viable a strategy as anything else the Americans tried. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. You and I had a disagreement on a previous show where I suggested that the American army should be used to assure the partition of Iraq, that basically the American army should be there as a sort of quote-unquote peacekeeping force, a blocking force, to divide the Sunnis and the Shias and Kurds and stop them from killing each other by acknowledging the reality that there is no Iraq as we once knew it that exists. That plan obviously has some flaws in it as well. But you're at the point where you really can't think of a worse way to have handled things than we did. But if you stop there, you would have, you know, with Iraq, you probably would have at least limited the damage. But instead, what happens is the United States then intrudes in another country that has internal divisions based broadly on Sunni Shia issues, which would be Syria. After ignoring the or delaying or trying to break apart the Arab Spring and most other countries, the U.S. kind of used it as an excuse in Syria in hopes of getting rid of Assad and installing a puppet more to our desire. So we kicked over another can in Syria. And if that wasn't enough, then we started bombing Libya, which was going to result in Gaddafi leaving power one way or the other. As it turns out, America's allies sodomized him on video and then stabbed him to death. And, you know, that was a nice touch. But, you know, without any plan for what was going to follow the regime change with another strong man. Libya or Yemen, the same thing. There are disparate forces there that were kept in check that we lose. So, I mean, we didn't just screw it up in Iraq. We basically followed an identical policy of screwing up in all these other countries. And that's where I come down with Bernie Sanders on saying this is the worst decision in American foreign policy history, because it didn't just affect one country primarily, as for example, the Vietnam War did. I know there was bleed over into Laos and Cambodia, but I mean, primarily that disaster was confined to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. This one has enveloped an entire region and has enveloped what is arguably the most volatile part of the world at present, and now has sucked in the other superpower, the Russians, who have come to play in Syria and are threatening to get more involved in Iraq, with them finding common cause with the Iranians. I mean, this is, and I mentioned this in the Tom Dispatch article, this is not dissimilar to what was happening in Europe prior to World War I, where the superpowers were gathering in very close proximity, waiting essentially for something to set off the spark to set it off.
All right, now I want to get back to the World War and Russia in a second, but as far as the Middle East policy goes, and this is something that I'm sure we've talked about before. In fact, I remember we've talked about before, but it's the never-ending riddle of stupidity or the plan or the stupid plan or just what is exactly the balance of what. Because I agree with you 100% when you talk about how, well, Iraq was supposed to be easy, right? I mean, same thing for Libya. This is all supposed to be easy. Robert Gates told Nancy Youssef, I'm sure you saw it the other day, Hillary's plan for Libya, we'll play it by ear. It'll be fine. And yet... it's never fine. It's such a disaster. You talk about Iraq split in three permanently now. I mean, yes, I refer to it as Iraqi Shiistan and the Islamic State now. I think those borders are real borders and that Iraq really is over. I agree with you that here comes total chaos from what was supposed to be a cinch. But then on the other hand, of course, there's, you know, mostly from the Likudnik and neocon side, there are papers after papers and rumors after articles where these guys say what we need to do is completely obliterate Middle Eastern society and form it into some new shape. Give them a boiling cauldron, in the words of Michael Ledeen. You could go back to the Yanan plan. The clean break is sort of a halfway plan between total chaos and, and you know, it'll be easy. We'll have a Hashemite king. We'll take care of it all for us and this kind of ridiculous stuff all mixed together. But, I mean, it does seem like Hillary Clinton, I disagree with her on everything, but she knows how to read and she's horrible, but she's not really stupid, right? But so, I mean, the story about Obama on the Libya war, Nancy Youssef's story, Obama was 51-49 for the war in Libya and let Hillary and Samantha Power and Susan Rice convince him over the dead bodies of the chiefs and the Secretary of Defense. And this is crazy. It makes more sense that they're serving the interests of people who want chaos, who want more terrorists to fight, who want to destroy Israel's enemies for them, et cetera, like that. So where do you come down on that gigantic mess?
You know, it's tough, but I tend to lean toward the chaos theory on these things. Because if you wanted to kind of destroy Israel's enemies, there are probably more and better ways to do that than setting off chaos, because chaos is by definition unpredictable. And particularly in an environment where there's terror groups that are always kind of looking around for the next failed state where they can set up camp, chaos in the Middle East is never a good thing. I mean, America could, for example, have facilitated Israeli moves into Syria for, quote-unquote, their own protection. And no one really could have done much about that other than make a lot of noise. America could have, in 2003, blasted its way right in across the Iranian border. And again, nobody could have really done much about that, and the Iranians themselves were in a rough position. So I think they may have deluded themselves at some level that they were helping Israel or helping this or that. I don't think that was really the primary mover in their mind. I think two things. One was what we now know was the Bush plan, which is essentially to conquer the Middle East for America, to grab the oil, to take control of these nations, to once and for all make the Middle East no longer a problem by controlling it. How'd that work out kind of question. I think the other thing goes back to the way business gets done in Washington. Take Hillary, for example. And as you know, I worked for the State Department for 24 years, and so have a better sense of how business gets done there than maybe some other agencies. These leaders live in a bubble to start with. They have people around them who agree with them all the time. And Hillary created sort of a bubble within a bubble, in that she, A, surrounded herself with longtime people who do nothing but tell her how right and smart she is. And that bubble functioned inside the bigger State Department bubble, where generally sucking up to the Secretary of State is a sport there. It's some people's only actual thing. I have a colleague in the State Department who actually named his child after Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, who was in charge at the time. Now, I mean, that's major league sucking up. I mean, that's pretty impressive stuff. And sent Powell a message, which never was acknowledged, telling him this. So, you know, you get Hillary who says, you know, I think we should get rid of the evil dictator Gaddafi, and this one will work where Iraq failed. And she's got people say, yes, madam, good idea. And then she's got the State Department people who rush around trying to find evidence to make her look good. She finds allies inside of the White House who are willing to support her. And there you go. You end up invading Libya. And I think that kind of thinking is underrated outside of Washington, simply because people have a natural desire to look for reasons. I mean, the stuff these people have done, Obama, Bush, I mean, it's insane. You know, when you start to go through it as you just did, or you list it up, I mean, it's just like, you know, how can they be this stupid? How can they be this ridiculous? And so there's this natural tendency to try to find a semi-rational explanation, even if you don't like it or agree with it. And in the end, you throw up your hands and say, holy shit, are these people dangerous? We're letting them loose with sharp objects all around the world.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that really gets people, is, like you're saying, where people can't believe it, is so many of us know better. And in real time, I mean, 150 million Americans knew better than to do Iraq in 02 and 03. And yet none of them lived in D.C. They were unanimous in D.C., but everybody else, or, well, millions, tens of millions, more than 100 million people were telling the pollsters, no, we should not do this. We know that Iraq didn't do 9/11. We know this is a bonus war these bastards are trying to get away with, and look at them do it anyway. On Libya, I mean, we had a much shorter run-up to the Libya war, but still, I had them on this show, Patrick Coburn and the best of them, saying, these guys are veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we're taking their side. And we knew that in real time the whole time.
Never mind people who are historians who can go back and find connections through history that say these are bad ideas. You know, you're left with this sense of America out of control, that we don't really know what else to do. There's this sense that America must do something. And so they sort of say, well, what can we do? And you end up choosing the option that you can do as opposed to the option that you should do. Sometimes the option, of course, is to do nothing, to step back from it and say this is not our problem, not our fight, or not something, even if we think it's our problem, not something that we have the ability to resolve. But in Washington, there's this sense that the world remains America's chessboard, and that when the other side makes a move, we are required to make a move of our own. And if we've only got certain pieces left on the board, well, that's the pieces we use. I think, excuse me, I have a bit of a cold. I think in a bizarre way, Putin moving into the Middle East may, and I may come back and eat these words, but I mean, may actually sort of calm things down a little bit. Up until Putin showed up, there was no one really there to say no to the United States. America could just do whatever the hell it wanted because the indigenous people, indigenous forces really were very weak, certainly militarily compared to the United States. I mean, most of them had no real allies that were going to step in. Putin at least can serve as some kind of a check on America's next dumb idea, if for no other reason than the United States doesn't want to risk open conflict with the Russians.
Right. Well, that was what I was going to ask you now to get back to them calling Obama's bluff here. You can't have your regime change in Syria because now they're in the way, but that leaves their planes and our planes bombing at least some of the same targets. And obviously America has an insane contradictory policy fighting on both sides of that civil war. The Russians are only on one side of it, but so we're sharing airspace with our enemies, the Russians, attacking our enemies, the Islamic State, not so much Al-Qaeda, our friends. But anyway, so you think there's a real danger here that these guys could blow us all up?
I'm terrified. I mean, you're putting an extraordinary amount of very dangerous weapons in a very small place. I mean, it's almost inevitable that something will happen, even if it falls into the realm of pure, complete, total, 100% accident. If you throw in the reality that both sides may be looking to cause a little trouble here or there and get away with it, labeling it an accident, it gets pretty serious pretty darn quickly. Imagine a Russian shoots down an American plane. Call it an accident. Pretend we have 100% visibility and know it was 100% an accident. I mean, could Obama really resist calls for no retaliation at this point?
Right. Right now he can't even leave, right? He has to stay, even though his bluff has been called and he can't get away with his regime change. He still has to stay there and he can't ally with the Russians, even though really, you know, if this was Hollywood or if this was the 1990s, maybe they'd just invite Russia to NATO and say, yeah, let's take on the terrorists together, something like that. They can't do that now. They're way too deep in pushing regime change against Assad, even though the Russians have agreed to negotiate his exit, you know, beforehand. But so, yeah, if they can't withdraw now that the Russians are fighting our war for us over there, the one that they're willing to admit to, then, no, I guess if it comes down to an actual dogfight, and obviously our crappy planes are going to lose, you know, I hope they're not using F-35s over there. But anyway, if one of our planes got shot down, yeah, and Obama's proven, Peter, over and over again that, you know, like when it comes to escalating an entire, tripling down the war in Afghanistan, it only comes down to his politics, you know, his own personal interests and what they're going to say about him and that kind of thing. That's the way you put it. You know, is he going to be able to resist the calls from the right to retaliate? I don't see any, you know, real example. Nope. I guess the Iran deal, but
maybe
that's different. That's not a fight. They didn't just shoot down our planes or anything.
Yep. And it's not done. It's not done in any way. But I mean, you know, this war is not over it's not going to be over when the next president, whoever he or she is, takes office. Now, the Republicans can't find enough reasons that they want to go to war with somebody. And, you know, if the election were held today, it's very likely that Hillary would be the next president. And she clearly can't wait to mix it up with Putin. You know, she's going to have to start her administration off by proving, you know, she's tougher than the boys. So, yeah, I mean, even if Obama gets away with kind of a half real, half show type of retaliation, the next president is not. The next president is going to be going for it. And at that point, you really have to, again, look to World War One, where forces get set in motion that are very, very hard to stop. Play the scenario out any way you want to. You know, Putin decides to retaliate to the retaliation in the Ukraine or moving through another country. The United States decides to pressure Putin through some means. The United States allows the Israelis to move further across the Golan Heights. Pick your scenario, it can turn very dangerous very, very quickly.
All right. Thanks very much for your time, Peter. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Scott. And like I said, we're never running out of stuff to talk about here.
Yeah, no, you got that right. Unfortunately, for a long, long time to come here, as long as we last.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Keep up the fight, my friend.
All right, y'all, that's Peter Van Buren. He is at TomDispatch.com and at WeMeantWell.com. He's got a new one there as well. America's killing of civilians is no accident. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. So, as far as I can tell from Twitter, nothing interesting is happening in this stupid Benghazi hearing at all, except a bunch of stupid crap, as any of us could have predicted. Oh, well. So, yeah, dude, let's talk about the worst war crimes in the world here. Yemen. I have a Yemen section here somewhere, if I can find it. Well, there's 22 killed in rocket fire round Taze. 22 civilians killed. I had another Yemen story here. It was about that they're starving and dying. I lost it. It was a UN report. Oh, no, I did talk about that. That's why I exited out. I mentioned that on the show yesterday, didn't I? The UN report that said that 500,000 children are suffering malnutrition there. For a country that imports 80 to 90% of its food... It's been under blockade for half a year. Seems strange that they're not just suffering malnutrition. Seems strange they're still alive at all. I don't know. And, you know, I'm sorry because that lady that I interviewed who was really great, who knew all about it, she had recommended all this stuff for me to read, and I just haven't gotten to it yet. But she had written up all this stuff previously about, you know, why the Yemenis import 80 to 90% of their food in the first place because of the IMF and World Bank screw you over loans. They come in and basically bribe the leaders to put the people in debt and steal all their resources from them. Same old, you know, gangsterism is protection. That's what government is, man. And that's how they do it. And anyway, that's why those people are so dependent on foreign food resources in the first place. Now they're being deprived of them. Oh, and here's one that I had forgotten that I never did get to. This is from way back on the 7th. The Houthis and the former ruling party back the UN plan on Yemeni peace. But the pro-Saudi factions are treating offers to talk as proof the war is going well. Ha ha, they're trying to negotiate with us. Let's keep bombing them. That just proves it's working. That sounds good. Anyway, again, just so there's no question or doubt in your mind, the Saudis don't really have a military of their own. It's just a part of ours, and they can't run it on their own. They don't do their own maintenance. They don't do their own nothing. It's all American contractors and American servicemen over there servicing their equipment. All the bombs, all the planes, and all the directions. American spies, military and civilian, CIA, are picking the targets and directing the Saudis who to bomb. The entire war is at Emperor Obama's pleasure. That's it. He could snap his fingers and end it. You think the Saudi king has power over his people? Oh, yeah, no, I remember that. That's a different subject. Yeah, no, good point. There were, well, you could talk about that. JDA is bringing up, there were previous false flags before the Nusra Turkey sarin attack in August of 2013. There were a couple from that spring, and in fact, in one of them, I'm trying to remember if it was the Turks or who it was, had immediately come out and blame, oh no, it was the Israelis. It was the Israelis had come right out and blamed Assad. Look, everyone, a chemical weapons attack. Assad did it. And John Kerry said, wait. And the way he did it was really obvious too. It was like, we're not ready to move forward with those allegations at this time or something like that. And in fact, there's a speech that I gave about Iran and North Korea, where, you know, they asked me to do a really long question and answer session, so that's why the thing is so long. But where we talk about that, and this was before, this was after the first couple of chemical weapons attacks, but before the big one, I think. And I said, yeah, you can see the Israelis' position on this, because there's been a couple little chemical weapons attacks, and the Israelis have tried to blame it on Assad, and Kerry told them, wait, not yet. We're not ready yet. And then it was a couple of months later was when they did it. Yeah, go back and check my work, youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. It's right there. Speech in San Angelo. Hey, San Angelo, guys. So now JDA thinks, oh, well, that must be why, Hillary had Stevens kill this, because he was going to not go along with that or something. If you have any evidence for that, I'd like to see it. Maybe he was just being funny and bringing up false flag chemical weapons attacks, which is always fun to do anyway. But, I don't know. You know what I ought to do, and I still got a couple of minutes. I ought to tell you about, because I actually know the story, of why there's a Yemen war in the first place. There are a handful of Al-Qaeda guys there, hardly anybody. Well, America backed the dictatorship in Yemen for a long, long time, at least since the early 90s. I wouldn't doubt, along with the British, all along or something. I don't know the whole history of it. But anyway, Saleh, the dictator there, has been the dictator for 30 years. America's had at least friendly relations with him and has been hardcore paying him for a generation. And especially since September 11th, they gave him all kinds of weapons and all kinds of millions and tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, I guess, in order to fight Al-Qaeda and allow America to do a drone war there. And this is especially in the Obama years. In fact, I think, Bush did one famous drone killing in Yemen, and that was it. But Obama really opened up the drone war in Yemen in the name of fighting Al-Qaeda and opened up the spigot of resources for the dictator, Saleh. Well, Saleh had kept attacking the Houthis, who are a branch of the Shiites. The Houthis are a political designation of a religious, a faction of people who have a religious designation as the Zaydis, who are a kind of Shia. And anyway, the Houthis were attacked by Saleh over and over again. And the more he attacked them, the stronger they got in fighting him off. And the more organized they became and really became a de facto government in the north there. Well, so then when the Arab Spring broke out in Tunisia and Egypt, etc., in Yemen, there became a huge protest movement, and it was just like in Egypt, where it was virtually all factions coming together to agree that we want rid of Saleh. And I don't know if the Houthis were showing up in the capital, but obviously they wanted rid of his ass too. And all the other factions did too. And so Hillary pulled off in Yemen what she couldn't pull off in Egypt, which was ease the guy out and replace him with the next mustache in line, as Greg Palast would say, and not have any real turmoil, any real regime change of the state, just of the leader. And so they replaced him with this guy Hadi. Well, that wasn't the end of Saleh. He went and made an alliance with the Houthis, who he had previously warred against, and they marched on the capital city. This whole time, America's still bombing Al-Qaeda with drones and making more and more of them with every drone strike. Again, stupidity or the plan. You can argue between which side, both sides of your hemispheres of your brain if you want, or among each other after the show. They just keep bombing and bombing and bombing Al-Qaeda in Yemen into existence, basically, making them more and more powerful than ever. And then, in order to compromise with the Saudis, basically, over the nuclear deal with Iran, Obama told them, fine, we can have a war in Yemen. And they've been fighting. America's been bombing Al-Qaeda with drones at the same time we are flying as their air force with the Saudis to try to put Hadi back into power and kick the Houthis back out of it. And America literally fighting for and against Al-Qaeda at the same time in Yemen right now, while, again, 500,000 children are on the brink of starvation. Or worse. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. So apparently an American was killed in a hostage rescue operation in Iraq today. Sent the Delta Force in to rescue some Kurds. They say that 70 hostages were rescued. I don't know. But anyway, so that's the latest news. But then there's this special report that I would like to direct your attention to. Iraq's power struggle, power failure in Iraq as militias outgun the state. And it's by our old friend Ned Parker. Haven't spoken with him in a long time. Wonder if I could get Ned Parker back on the show to talk about this, man. That'd make for a good interview. It's been a long time since I talked with him. He used to write for the LA Times. Anyway, so yeah, this was part of Van Buren's, article that we didn't get to talk about. He sort of barely referred to it there, that there are factions within factions here. Remember when he said that? And he talks about that in his article about how we could well have a civil war among the Shia powers. Because we used to have, America had put the strong man, Nouri al-Maliki, and his Dawa party in power there. And he had really, you know, made his own power since he really ran the state. He refused to appoint ministers to the highest position, so everybody in the government answered basically directly to him. But America and Iran agreed to ease him out a year and a half ago. After the failure of the Iraqi army to hold Mosul when the Islamic State came in, they got rid of him and they replaced him with a body who is a much weaker character. And according to Van Buren's article, this has really helped. At the same time, just the war itself, the renewal of the civil war itself, has helped to re-energize the Shiite militias and increase their power, meaning increasing their power relative to his. And so we really could see a coup d'etat against Abadi, could see even a civil war among the Shiite factions. Although, as long as they're united attacking the Islamic State, they can probably put that priority ahead of a real civil war, but you certainly see major faction fights. And see, the thing is, regardless of all the hype you're ever going to hear about this, the Shiites are not going to lose Baghdad unless, you know, America nukes them. It took America's Army and Marine Corps 5 years to make that basically 90-something percent Shiite city now. And that's about the level of power it would take to give it back to the Sunnis. So that was what I was talking about with him about they can fling suicide bombers at it forever. And they will, because they will not tolerate their failure and their loss there. But there's really nothing that they can do about it. Baghdad isn't really under threat. It's a big city. And they have no ability to take it from the population that lives there. And anyway, so, point is to focus just on Iraqi Shiistan, as I guess it should be called now. Ned Parker. Power failure in Iraq as militias outgunned the state. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi came to office a year ago promising to rebuild his country, but the Iraqi state has grown weaker as power has leaked to Shiite militia leaders. In April, Prime Minister Abadi sat at a conference table in his Baghdad office with almost two dozen men in combat fatigues. They were not officers in the Iraqi army, but representatives of the Shiite paramilitary groups that have led the fight against the Islamic State. Hadi al-Amiri, one of the most senior militia leaders, delivered a long and forceful monologue on his fighters' recent victories. And that's the Bada Brigade is who Amiri is. Abadi, in his blazer and tie, listened, occasionally jotting down notes. A video of the meeting shows. A few minutes later, Abadi himself praised the fighters. The event was a sign of the delicate balance of power in Iraq. Iraqi Shiistan. From Baghdad down to Kuwait there, what's left of it. Abadi, a Shia, came to office just over a year ago, backed by the U.S. and Iran. He promised to rebuild the fragmented country he inherited from Nouri al-Maliki, his predecessor, who was widely accused of fueling sectarian divisions. Since then, though, even more power has shifted from the government to the militia leaders. Those leaders are friendly with Abadi, but the most influential describe themselves as loyal not only to Iraq, but to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Three big militias, Amiri's Badr organization, Asaib al-Al-Haq, and Khatib Hezbollah, use the Iranian Shiite cleric's image on either their posters or websites. Badr officials describe their relationship with Iran as good for Iraq's national interests. These are the guys who, you know, me and antiwar.com have been telling you for 13 years now. These are the guys waiting to inherit power from Saddam Hussein when George Bush does their dirty work for him. They were the Iraqi traitors who fled to Iran and fought on Iran's side after Jimmy Carter hired Saddam to invade Iran. Well, I gave him the green light to do it anyway. Anyway, initially, Abadi had little choice but to lean on the Shiite paramilitary forces. They grew in power after Sunni extremist group Islamic State, or I think the word "the" belongs in the article, "the" belongs in the sentence somewhere, captured large parts of northern Iraq in June last year, and Iraq's top Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, called for volunteers to fight the Islamic State, which soon declared a caliphate straddling the border with neighboring Syria. As the Shia militia's popularity surged, Abadi publicly lamented the lack of Western support. He made plain his desperate desire for help earlier this month after Iran and Russia opened offensives against the group in Syria. The prime minister said he would welcome Russian airstrikes in Iraq as well. Abadi is looking not just to hurt the Islamic State, but to bolster his own position in Iraq. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and change the subject now to these other ones, because the Jason Ditz has U.S. tells Iraq to choose between them and Russia in the ISIS war. Now, the Iranian/Russian Shiite Crescent Alliance obviously and clearly includes Iraq. It's the Americans who refuse to let it go, who refuse to admit they fought their war for their adversaries. America is on Saudi and Al-Qaeda's side in this one. And for that matter, at least de facto, the Islamic State side. And so here the Russians are saying, yeah, we're working with the Iraqis. We're sharing intelligence and we're helping them fight. Although I don't guess there's Russian airstrikes in Iraq yet. But the American General Joe Dunford said, oh, Iraq doesn't want any of Russia's help. Right? And that's like a five-year-old going, oh, yeah, no, Toby told me to tell you he doesn't want to be your friend anymore, or whatever kind of thing. Anyway, why Toby? I don't know. I had a friend named Toby when I was a kid. Anyway, yeah, there you go. America always fighting against themselves in all these wars. Against us. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm looking at MondoWeiss.net, as I am often wont to do. MondoWeiss.net, Philip Weiss and Adam Horowitz. No, not the Beastie Boy, the other guy. Despite global disgust, Netanyahu doubles down on claim that Hitler got the idea for the final solution from a Palestinian. What a kook this prime minister is. Am I right? He actually had to say, I did not mean to absolve Hitler. The prime minister of Israel. I didn't mean to absolve Hitler. I was just saying. And of course, this guy, Ben White, who's a Palestinian, pro-Palestinian activist, I saw him tweet it out this morning. The Nazis are quoting Netanyahu and saying he's, quote, completely factual. The prime minister of Israel from now on will be cited by the Nazis saying, yeah, see. In fact, David Irving, the most famous of the Holocaust deniers, I once heard him on a radio show in the 1990s where he said, I'm actually no longer a Holocaust denier. Oh boy, nobody quote that out of context. That was me quoting David Irving. I never was. But he's saying he was no longer a Holocaust denier. For whatever reason, I guess I read later it was because he had read Eichmann's papers and went, oh, really? Wow. But he had a new position that he argued. It was on the Shannon Burke show here in Austin, Texas. And he was arguing that, well, Hitler didn't know about it. It was only his underlings and deputies, but Hitler wasn't the one who made the call. So I'm sure all those, David Irving, Holocaust deniers will now be citing Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, the son of a historian, the prime minister of Israel, as saying that they're right. Even Benjamin Netanyahu admits, they will say, from now on. And of course, all Netanyahu was trying to do was try to blame the Palestinians, who on most days you're supposed to believe don't exist and never existed. But this time they existed just so that they could be behind the Holocaust. Now, Angela Merkel, the president, or is she the prime minister or the president? She's the chancellor of Germany. She has said, no, it was us Germans what did that. And we take responsibility, thanks. And so don't take it away from us. Wow. And then all the historians in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem denounced him and said he didn't know what he was talking about. But now get this, and I read about 6 or 10 articles about this, because I don't know everything about the Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem. Maybe he did recommend genocide, and maybe he did on this date or that date, and with a box and with a fox, and I don't know. So I'm reading up on this, and it turns out, well, I don't know if it turns out. One of the things I read is that Netanyahu is citing an aide to Adolf Eichmann, who at the Nuremberg trials went on and on about it and said that the Mufti of Jerusalem had said all this stuff to Hitler and to the rest of them, that here's what you ought to do. So, I don't know. And then they said, well, he was never prosecuted. Oh, he escaped? Oh, no, different guy. That guy, they dropped the charges against him or whatever. He never testified about it. Al-Husseini was never prosecuted at Nuremberg either. And so it was never, I guess, you know, firmly nailed down. But that's a pretty strong source. An aide to Adolf Eichmann, if he's the one who said it. So now that doesn't mean that that's where Hitler got the idea, or that was the motivation for, you know, Himmler and the Gestapo and whatever. Come on. But it could mean that that guy was a real jerk. The worst. A Hitler-loving, Nazi-collaborating SOB. But so what? What the hell does that have to do with the Palestinian victims of the Israeli, brutal Israeli grand theft of their land, and subject to its permanent occupation for now half a century? It's got 100% of nothing to do with it at all. That's supposed to somehow justify Israeli crimes against the subject population? I'm not impressed. And I've seen it said, and I don't know this, you know, I'm not a master of this kind of history, but I've seen it said that thousands, many tens of thousands of Palestinians fought with the British and the Allies against the Axis powers. And that this guy who, you know, supposedly had recruited some people to fight for the Nazis or for the Axis, yeah, I guess for the Nazis in Bosnia, that that didn't amount to anything. And it paled in comparison to the Arab and especially Palestinian contribution to the Allied cause. Now, I don't know the whole truth of that or whatever, but as much as that muddies the water, it actually still doesn't mean a thing anyway. What does any of this have to do with the victimization of the Palestinians now or even ever since 1948? It's got nothing to do with it. And the horrible truth that has been replicated numerous times all through human history, all over the planet, and is true in this case, it's not especially unique. But what happened is the Israelis successfully cleansed their nation of the people who lived there so that they could have it. That's what they call it. That's the term for it, cleansed. That ain't my term. I think it's ridiculous. Cleansed? But that's what they did. They guaranteed that they had an 80-20 super-duper majority, so that that way they could pretend to be a democracy, but they would always be a Jewish state too. And that was, you know, the Nakba's a war crime. The fact that the Palestinian refugees in exile all across the Middle East is horrible. But I'm just saying it was sustainable. That's all I'm saying. But then what happened was the 67 war. And it's not that the people of the West Bank launched the war or anything like that. The people of the Gaza Strip, Israel launched the war. They got into a war and, you know, their prime minister, Menachem Begin, admitted that they started the war and called it a preemptive strike against the Egyptians. But the Egyptians weren't really moving on them and they knew it, according to their prime minister, their famous Prime Minister Begin. But anyway, that was a fight between Israel, Syria, Egypt, and I think Jordan came in late, right? Do I remember that right? And anyway, so the Palestinians must be made to suffer from now on. The Israelis conquered the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, and they're keeping it, but no second Nakba. They didn't kick all the people out. I'm not saying that that would be fair or nice or anything but a horrible war crime and a tragedy, but at least that would make sense. What doesn't make sense, even from a government, you know, a state imperial point of view, what doesn't make sense is occupying them and ruling them under a military dictatorship forever and slowly colonizing their land apartment by apartment and stealing the third most important holy site in Islam in the process of taking these people's land and doing it the way they're doing it and putting the people of Palestine through the suffering that they're putting them through. Someone wants to try to justify this by citing what some Palestinian said to Hitler or anyone else in the 1930s or the 1940s? Give me a break. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. So, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show, wrapping up for the day here. Sorry I'm nothing but bad news around here, man, but what are you going to do? I don't know if you guys heard me. There was dead air on the show. The dang radio station broke. And so maybe y'all didn't get to hear me say that I am writing the book with Tom Woods. He announced it a long time ago, back before we were ready to go at all. And then a bunch of stuff happened, including he had to do the whole Ron Paul curriculum and all this stuff. And I don't know. Anyway, so but now it's on, though. Tom is, he's taking a proposal to his literary agent guy and going to see if he can get that guy to see if he can get us a deal. So, maybe I'll write a book about why there shouldn't be a war. That'd be cool. And then it'll have Tom Wood's name on it, which means people will read it. So that'd be nice. Probably couldn't end a war with a book, but would be nice to help to contribute to people liking war less or something by writing one, maybe. All right, well, so yeah, that's going on. Also, man, I went and I looked to see how many interviews I got now, and I realized there's some drafts in there in the interviews category. And I deleted one of them, one that I knew was a double, you know, and the count went down one. So drafts count. So now how many drafts are there? Many. How many drafts are there in the interviews category? I don't know. It's going to take a long time to find out. We're talking about basically a WordPress blog with 10,000 entries. Half of them are interview entries almost, right? So it could be that I'm a lot further away from 4,000 interviews than I thought. I got to go back and see which of those drafts actually got published, but just it was a different entry and somehow it's a double. and which ones still need to just have publish hit on them, even if they're 6 years old. I have no idea. So I thought I was a week away from 4,000, but that might not be right. I might never get to 4,000. But I might, you know. So we'll see about that. I got to go through and see if I can get Adam to help me go through and figure out which of those just need to go to the trash. All right. Now, so, yeah, I guess I want to talk about Palestine some more, man. I don't know. Actually, what I want to say is help support the show if you can. Help advertise on the show if you can. That's what I really need. I need so many advertisers that I don't have to ask for donations. That's how the show should be. That's the model of the show. It's an advertising model. And yes, I had to do better at chasing down possible advertisers and getting that work done. I'm not a very good businessman. So it's your responsibility, damn it. Email me and say, hey, I'll advertise on your show, and then we'll work something out. ScottHorton.org. I'll sell you some ads. That email address, by the way, is also available, coincidentally, at ScottHorton.org/donate. We can sign up for monthly donations, or you can do one-off ones, or whatever you want. Okay, cool. And I just thought, you know, I probably better mention that. If you like there being a show, then you have to give money to the show for there to be a show. Because all things run on money. Not that it takes very much to get this done. As you could probably tell by the shoddy production values. Palestinian viewpoints on the Intifada from the West Bank, Gaza, and Lebanon by Pam Bailey at MondoWeiss.net. Whether the clashes in Jerusalem and the West Bank are the long-awaited third Intifada is the question being asked by virtually every journalist covering the Middle East. It takes stabbings and house burnings to get the media's attention. Once it stops, attention will swing back to the Islamic State and the neglected refugees at sea, leaving the Palestinians to suffer their decades-long occupation alone once again. Even among Palestinians, the answer to the question varies. The youngest are more likely to say yes and to glory in the feeling of empowerment, however temporary. The older the person I interviewed, with some exceptions, the more jaded they became. However, there is one common truth among the people on, quote, the street. The uprising is once again bringing them together, at least in spirit, across borders, from East Jerusalem to Gaza City to Beirut. Views of Gaza. Everyone is watching TV wherever I go, even at the hair salon, says Maha Husseini, who is studying for her master's degree in political science in Gaza. Among her friends, support is strong. There is a sense of unity with the West Bank. Even when the news came in that the seven youths had died that day after Israeli forces shot them during a solidarity protest at the border, her friends, quote, strongly supported the demonstration. I heard a couple of people say that even if the protest didn't result in anything, it shows that our spirit has not been broken and that Palestinians here support the Palestinians there. They think it is the third Intifada, and if not, they want it to begin. Aboud Asfar, a reporter for Alqana TV, who lives less than a mile from the watchtowers along the Israeli border, agrees. The Intifada has started, and it's here in Gaza now. The politicians are afraid to say that, but the young people are ready. Not everyone in Gaza agrees, however. It has only been a year since Israel launched a major assault on the strip that left more than 2,000 dead and more than 10,000 wounded. Tens of thousands more remain displaced. Ahmed Al-Nouk, an English literature student whose brother was killed in the 2014 assault, says emotionally, I support what is happening there, the West Bank, but I think Gaza should step aside this time. We are not ready for another war. Hossam Al-Maroun, who heads the non-profit, you see the difference there is, Ariel Sharon pulled the Israeli Jewish settlers out of Gaza, so now they have no, quote, human shields. And so they can just be slaughtered with impunity like they're livestock or something, like they're nothing. Whereas in the West Bank, they can't really bring total war to the people of the West Bank because their property is bisected by Jewish-Israeli colonists all over the place. And so that would be too much trouble, you see. That was the brilliance of unilateral withdrawal from Gaza in 2005. Turn it from a colonized piece of slowly stolen property to a simple prison. For a majority minor population, by the way, if you can have one of those. Are they still minors if they're the majority under the age of 18? I support what is happening there, but I think we should step aside this time. We're not ready for another war, said the guy whose brother got exploded to death last time, understandably. Hossam al-Madun, who heads the nonprofit Mon Development Center in Gaza, which treats many children with PTSD, supports resistance, but not by attempting to respond to violence with violence. Human beings were created with a passion for freedom, and there will always be a struggle to get it. But my worry is that we'll see a repeat of 2014. That conflict also started in the West Bank, and then Israel provoked Gaza, which is a correct fact. They were bombing Gaza long before the first rocket was ever fired in retaliation. It's easy for Israel to wage war and convince the world it's only defending itself. We will never defeat them with weapons. We can defeat them with peace, nonviolence only. Anyway, it goes on like that. Just a little bit of a idea of what you don't usually get to hear when you're watching TV, the view of these people. Especially in conservative media. I swear, conservatives think that there already is an independent Palestinian state which is constantly attacking Israel. And it's, you know, there's a cognitive dissonance in there. They know they're colonizing the West Bank and they support it. But they just refuse to call it what it is. It's like Jeffrey Goldberg had a piece in The Atlantic explaining that, you know, them Arabs are just racist. That's how they are. Everybody knows that. I mean, yeah, we've been killing them and stealing all their stuff, but that's not why they're mad. They're mad because of their race. Makes them that way. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.